to make a huge amount of money might have spotted this, and no one else, and could have made a huge amount of money, and then the consequences would have been far, far more serious. Mm. And that's why budgets have to be kept secret, in order that we hear about the details all at the same time, so nobody has privileged extra information that they can then make a lot of money out of. So that was the gaffe of the year. I mean, the other things made people look a bit stupid, whereas this one could have been economically, financially disastrous.
Yes, absolutely. And just finally, we've only got a few seconds left, Michael. Yeah. Is there another little personal favourite from the honourable mentions? Is it the Tories putting out a chocolate bar at their conference where they couldn't even spell the word Britain? Or is it Labour continuing to throw out policy reversals like today's Farmers one, just weeks after the budget? Which, in 10 seconds, which is your favourite?
Well, I think my favourite one, actually, is Kemi Badenoch doing an interview for, I think it was Irish Radio, and saying that Northern Ireland had voted for Brexit when, in fact, it hadn't.
Yes.
It voted for Remain by 56-44. It's confusing. Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to Remain. Wales and England didn't. But
we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, as ever, the brilliant journalist and author, Michael Crick.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. I'm John Harvey and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we'll delve into the Epstein files, metaphorically, as the biggest drop of photos, emails and documents so far has been released. The England cricket team is under fire for reports of players drinking excessively during a break from the Ashes. We'll talk all things cricket with Elizabeth Ammon. Plus, the now legendary annual Sgt. Pepper's celebrity montage is in its 10th and final year. We'll speak to the artist behind it, Chris Barker. First, though, the news with Daryl Jackson.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The National Farmers Union says many of its members will sleep more easily this Christmas after a government U-turn on inheritance tax. The threshold is increasing from £1 million to £2.5 million. It's following months of protests and tractors descending on Westminster. Here's Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds.
We listen to those farmers and businesses who will be affected, and as a result, 85% of farming estates who claim agricultural property relief will now pay no inheritance tax.
Two men have been found guilty of plotting a gun attack on a mass gathering of Jews in Manchester. Walid Sadawi and Amar Hussein are said to have been inspired by Islamic State. The trial heard the pair had a visceral dislike of Jewish people and wanted to kill as many as they could. Assistant Chief Constable Robert Potts says it could have been Britain's deadliest terrorist incident.
It could have been utterly devastating based on the weaponry and the ammunition that they were taking possession of. Very sadly, we only need to look at recent events in Australia to see the damage and the devastation that can be caused by firearms.
A man's appeared in court in Swindon, charged with 56 sexual offences against his ex-wife. Philip Young's accused of drugging and raping his former partner over a 13-year period. He's been remanded into custody. The US Justice Department says thousands of newly released documents about Jeffrey Epstein contain untrue and sensationalist claims against Donald Trump. The latest files released this morning include an email suggesting the US president travelled on the late paedophile's private jet 8 times. Greta Thunberg has been arrested in central London at a protest backing Palestine Action hunger strikers. City of London police say a 22-year-old woman was detained for displaying a placard supporting a banned group. A mid-Ashes holiday enjoyed by England's cricketers in Australia is being investigated by their bosses. They had a break in the Queensland beach town Noosa, where some players reportedly drank excessively before losing the third test and the series. But former England bowler Steve Harmison has told us it's not black and white.
If they've gone 60 a bender, bang them against the wall, you get what they deserve. If they've been caught having a couple of pints in the middle of the afternoon, yeah, when the world is ending, yeah, I'm not hammering them for this.
A leading dog rescue charities warned they'll be operating at capacity this Christmas. The Dogs Trust says the number of inquiries from owners about giving up their pets remains high, following a peak in inquiries in 2022. Richard Moore from the charity says so far this year they've managed to rehome more than 8,500 animals.
We had 50,000 people call us over the course of 2022 needing help to find homes for their dogs, and we expect over 40,000 calls for similar reasons before the end of this year.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing, which is on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who comes round on special night?
Who comes round on special night?
Special night.
Well, it's 4 minutes past two. I'm John Harvey, and I'm with you for another 2 hours of news, features, culture and comments until the great John Pienaar takes the reins of the presenter's sleigh at four. And getting us started for this hour is, well, the unmistakable sound of Bob Dylan with a slice of his 2009 Christmas album, which is simultaneously strangely heartwarming and sounds a bit like it might have been recorded under duress. You gotta love him. Coming up between now and three, we'll be hearing the very latest from America after the US Department of Justice released the biggest tranche so far of the Epstein files. The great journalist Michael Crick, who has just been joining me for a trip through Westminster gaffes, will have another look at what's happening in politics. I'll also be talking to the artist who's become famous for his annual obituary montage in the style of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper cover. And we'll go epic by decoding Homer's Odyssey with classicist Daisy Dunn in the wake of Christopher Nolan releasing the trailer for his blockbuster movie out next summer. Then later in the show, we'll be asking whether the Victorians invented Christmas as we know it, or did they ruin it? On which note, do you already have festive fatigue? Is there one aspect of Christmas you'd gladly erase if you had the chance? Well, you've got till 4 p.m. to tell us, vent your spleen with our virtual amnesty. A couple of messages we've just had in the last hour. Debbie says, I'd get rid of the awful tradition in a lovely Christmas service when you're expected to hug other people you've never met and will never see again. Spoils the whole thing. I agree with you on that. I thought the pandemic would have wiped that out, but there we are. And Sean in Bradford says, personally, I would ban all people who go to the pub at Christmas for their once a year outing. They have zero idea of how people should behave in pubs. Standing, blocking the bar, taking 5 minutes to decide what they want, ordering a round, then a pint of Guinness last in the order, drinking as if they are hardened drinkers, and then, well, throwing up. Thank you for that, Sean. Have you got a bete noir you'd like to throw out with the wrapping paper? Do get in touch. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. You can drop us a text on 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. Now, though, the US Department of Justice has released another tranche of files relating to Jeffrey Epstein, the biggest release so far. There's around 30,000 pages of documents, video clips and photos, many with redactions. Harriet Alexander is a journalist based in New York, and she's with me now to discuss them. Hello, Harriet.
Hi, John. Hello.
So what's new in the files, Harriet, or is it even too soon to say?
Well, yes, I mean, it is rather too soon because, of course, it takes a lot of wading through these files to work out what's in them. We got the previous release on Friday and we're still getting a sort of drip of information about those. One thing that I think is really interesting is that the Justice Department, when it released this, it did so with a statement basically caveating the files, saying that there was lots of untrue or sensationalist claims about Donald Trump, which they haven't done before. It's sort of warning people before they read them, which is quite unusual. But yes, I mean, one of the key things is that there is an email from people in the Southern District of New York, in the Justice Department, to presumably Donald Trump's team, warning them that the president was actually on Jeffrey Epstein's private jet many times more than had been previously believed.
Yeah, you mentioned this, as you say, slightly strange statement by the Department of Justice, which is releasing the files and yet clearly putting out partisan opinion. But is there any way which this information, which would appear, we can't be sure, but if these the flight manifests and stuff, how can those sort of things be taken as being untrue? What's the argument there?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there basically is no argument, John, that the flight manifest is the flight manifest. One thing that was certainly untrue that they put out, they released what appeared to be a video of Epstein hanging himself in his cell. It was quite a bizarre video. And then they later clarified that actually that was something that they were forwarded, that had been doing the rounds online. It was just a sort of AI type fake video. But that was released as part of the document. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of scrambling to try and find out what things are. There is some redaction happening after the event as well. They even released the files for a few hours yesterday evening and then took them back offline and then released them again. So, you know, it's not the most orderly process. And also, it's not being released in an orderly way. You just literally have to trawl through these tens of thousands of pages each time.
Yes, well, if we put all this together, you mentioned the chaos, and also, as you said, something bizarre to be releasing fake AI videos as part of this. And there's a phrase which has long been mentioned, not only in MAGA circles, but it's sort of a political tactic of, they call it flooding the zone. Could this be part of the analysis of what's going on here, that in order to try and make this as difficult for the true information to be sifted through as possible, is that might possibly be what's going on?
Yes, I think a lot of people do believe that. It's actually interesting that Bill Clinton, who featured heavily in the first release on Friday, his spokesperson is saying, release all of this immediately, because he's saying, you know, this is being done in a very calculated way, that you are getting Bill Clinton out there, so everybody's talking about that. Is that a way to sort of hide from other information that you don't necessarily want out there? I would also note that the timing is quite interesting. They were supposed to release it all on Friday, and yet, of course, they didn't. Obviously, as it gets closer and closer to Christmas, people are paying less attention to the news. So is that something to do with it as well? That's what a lot of people are suspicious of.
Well, then let's spool forwards then. And do you know how many of the files are left? Does anybody know what's left to be released? And is that the idea that potentially the holiday period would see more of this stuff? And what's the response from the US government, if there is one, or even from Trump?
Yes, I mean, we've only so far had a fraction of what is actually out there. There's an awful lot more to come. Donald Trump was asked about this on Monday evening. He's down in Mar-a-Lago, his Florida resort, for Christmas. He was quite irritated about being asked about it yet again, because it was at a ceremony where he was announcing he wanted to rename some warships after himself. But he wanted to talk about the warships and not about Jeffrey Epstein. He says it's well known that I used to spend time with him, but he said everybody spent time with him, and that actually is becoming more and more true, isn't it? That's more and more apparent. Trump says, you know, that I've done nothing wrong. I got rid of him. I ditched him in the mid-2000s because he was, quote, a creep. And it is certainly believed to be true that they weren't long-standing friends after the mid-2000s. There is some damaging information there, of course, about Prince Andrew. There's an email from August 2001 to Ghislaine Maxwell, in which Andrew requests that she finds him some inappropriate friends. And she replies and she says, I could only find you appropriate friends. And he says, distraught.
Yes. Well, it's astonishing how each tranche of files seems to create wave upon wave of drama and controversy on both sides of the Atlantic. Well, and as you say, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and Donald Trump deny any wrongdoing. But thank you so much for your analysis of that. Harriet Alexander, a journalist based in New York. Now, the England cricket team are investigating claims that players spent a four-day mini break shortly before the Adelaide Test drinking excessive amounts of booze. The team director, Rob Key, has defended the decision to go ahead with the break after the 8-week wickets defeat in Brisbane in the second test, but said any accusations of heavy drinking must be looked into. Well, joining me to discuss this is Elizabeth Ammon, chief cricket reporter, for The Times. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Well, what exactly are the accusations being made? There are sort of conflicting reports of how much boozing went on, and cricketers have done this since time immemorial. What is the crux of the story, if we even know?
Well, I mean, several things. That obviously the England team was sort of tailed fairly closely by the Australian media. That's the way it goes on Ashes tours. Several photos of them drinking, videos of them drinking, but... today a video has emerged of opener Ben Duckett being clearly very inebriated during that Noosa trip to the point of sort of swaying and not knowing how he was going to get home, which is also being investigated. The break itself was a planned break. They didn't have any training. It was a genuine break. So it's a case of the ECB looking at whether their conduct fell below the requirements that they had on them. Of course, they were not told they weren't allowed to drink. They were allowed to go out and have lunch, have dinner, have, you know, a normal amount of booze. But I think what's being investigated is whether that went too far. It's pretty standard for an Ashes test for there to be accusations of England drinking too much. There was on the last tour and the tour before that. But obviously, had they been 3-0 up rather than 3-0 down and already surrendered the series, it might not have been quite so much of an issue.
Well, you mentioned Ben Duckett there, the opener. And I mean, as a cricket fan, I wouldn't be surprised if he had one too many, because being able to leave is something he seems to be incapable of doing. But I suppose the big question is, from your cricketing expert eyes, was there any sign that England were playing any worse after the alleged drinking took place? I guess that's the key thing, isn't it?
Because actually better.
Right.
They showed some signs of fight in the Adelaide test, the third test. You know, there was on the final day, the fifth day, they got within 100 runs of the chase. By then they were already 2-0 down and the wheels had come off. But the way it is with Ashes tours is once the wheels come off, they start coming off really, really quickly, and then they're sort of sniping in the camp. The Australian media is pretty relentless. There wasn't any signs that break in Noosa, which was a planned break between tests, had any sort of detrimental effect. And they got to Adelaide 3 days before the series and trained hard as they normally do.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because I read that Joe Root didn't go on this trip to Noosa, obviously England's greatest batsman. And of course, he had a less successful test in the Adelaide. So the statistics would almost bear out the having the fund. What about the Australian camp? Because obviously there's a big cliche about Australian drinking. But in reality, in 2025, has there been a stricter approach in the Australian camp? Or are they just better managed?
Well, it's slightly different, of course, when it's a home series, because they go home mm-hmm. to their families. So they're not sort of in the breaks between test matches. They're not together as a camp. So that's sort of, you know, there's fewer opportunities. They are better drilled and better, more relentless. They seem a bit sort of, more well regimented. At the beginning of the series, there were some quite interesting things to do with Usman Khawaja being lambasted by his home media about playing golf the day before the test match and then having a back spasm. So they will go after their own players if there's any sense that they've been doing anything, but there isn't any hint that Australia are being anything other than pretty disciplined.
Yes, it's often the case that these stories sort of follow the team who are down on their luck and not doing so well, isn't it? And England have, I guess, in one sense, are reaping what they've sown by being so outplayed. Just finally then, Elizabeth, of course, historically and famously, we've got the Boxing Day test to come at the MCG. Was it 100,000 fans baying for English blood? Is there any sign that there could be an upturn in fortunes?
If we're clutching at straws, then obviously the last 2 days of Adelaide, they showed a bit of fight. Jamie Smith and Will Jacks showed some fight with the bat. But, and of course, Australia will be missing Nathan Lyon, their premier spinner, who's got a hamstring injury. They're missing their captain, Pat Cummins, who's nursing a back injury. There's no Josh Hazlewood, one of the other premier fast bowlers. So there is an opportunity for them to get things back and to show a bit of fight. But the way things go with Ashes is it's really hard to come back. They've also got their own problems, England. They don't, you know, there's some selection issues. Do they drop Ollie Pope? What do they do about the bowling? Do they bring in a different spinner? There is an opportunity, but the series is gone and it's all a bit late.
Yes, it does feel a little bit after the Lord Mayor's Parade. I guess if you are going to watch, as I think I will be on Christmas night, it sounds like whoever they pick, it's one for England fans to watch from behind the sofa. Thank you so much for getting us up to speed on the latest saga in the Ashes. That's Elizabeth Ammon, cricket reporter for The Times. Coming up, we'll delve into the story behind Christopher Nolan's next blockbuster. It's 2:18. You're listening to John Harvey on Times Radio.
Newsmakers with Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Join me on Christmas Day for a festive look back on my favourite newsmaker interviews from the past year. I'll be revisiting my conversations, like diving into the origins of gold as a measure of wealth with the author Dominic Frisby. And you'll hear from the Republican politician Bob McEwen following the fatal shooting of his friend Charlie Kirk.
Newsmakers with Kate Borsay. Christmas Day from 7pm on Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
It's just coming up to 2:20. I'm John Harvey, and let's talk movies, because British director Christopher Nolan is arguably the biggest filmmaker working in Hollywood today. He's already got a Batman trilogy, Inception, Dunkirk and Oppenheimer under his belt. And for his next epic adventure, he's turned to one of the oldest stories ever told, Homer's Odyssey. Yesterday, the first trailer dropped for Nolan's take on the ancient epic of Odysseus's long voyage home, and it's set to be the biggest movie of 2026. Let's hear a taste.
After years of war, no one could stand between my men.
Well, what is the enduring appeal of this 2,500-year-old yarn? And could the film do it justice? Joining me for an Odyssey into the Odyssey is classicist and author Daisy Dunn. Hello, Daisy.
Hello.
Well, I don't know if you're excited. I certainly am. And the thing is, many, many people will have heard the word Odyssey, but far fewer will have read the story itself or know much about the man at the centre of it. So to begin with, tell us, what is the original epic all about?
I'm super excited about this because the Odyssey is the ultimate classic. It's almost the classic classic from ancient Greece. It's one of the earliest poems that we have from the Western world. And it tells the story of the homecoming of Odysseus, who was one of the soldiers who fought at Troy. He survived the Trojan War, but the bigger epic that kind of confronts him is his homecoming. So he needs to get back to his island of Ithaca. And it takes him a jolly long time because he encounters lots of different monsters and impediments on the way.
Yes, Odysseus himself, he is a fascinating figure, isn't he? Because he's not all about brute strength like so many heroes like Achilles or Ajax or lots of sort of movie heroes we know about. But he's all about cunning, trickery and deception. And these are ambiguous qualities. So is he someone to admire? And did the Greeks admire him?
Well, he's really the kind of the brains to their brawn, if you like. He's the one who came up with the stratagem of the Trojan horse. And I think for that, people really, really admired him. In the story, he gets a lot of respect for his cunning. But as you say, it's a bit two-sided. I mean, he really has a capacity to be a great liar when he wants to be. And certainly he can be quite sort of economical with the truth. I mean, one of the things that delays him, causes him such a long time to get home, is the fact that he whiles away years and years with a beautiful nymph called Calypso. So, you know, he has the capacity to lie and to deceive, as well as to be very, very cunning.
Yes, a cunning and deceit. It's all there, isn't it? Yeah, it's that idea that, oh, I would have got home sooner, but I was sadly trapped on an island with a beautiful nymph who kept forcing me to have sex with her.
It's so hard for him. It's so difficult. He was there, you know, he said, I was crying on the rocks. It was so miserable. What a hard time I had.
It's the age old story. Well, I think I think lying is going to come into this a bit more, because I want us to move on to this new film version. And some people are surprised that Christopher Nolan is doing this. He's often done sci-fi, and you know, his last film was about the atomic bomb. But he's famous for his complex scripts with time shifts, unreliable narrators and the like. You know, Inception, is it all a dream? The Prestige, is it all a trick? And I have a theory that this is why he's been drawn to The Odyssey, because that story is full of trickery, isn't it?
It is, and I think this is the difficulty with it as a narrative, because the kind of the really exciting bit of the poem, the bit where you encounter the Cyclops, the one-eyed monster, the Lotus Eaters, the Sirens, Circe, all these wonderful creations, they're all told by Odysseus himself to a group of people who he's happened upon. So you have to kind of question, is he making it all up? Is it all just this great fantasy that he's relaying to these people because he wants these people to help him to get home, to give him a ship so he can finally complete his journey? Or did it happen? So there's a real kind of slipperiness within the poem itself, which I can imagine Christopher Nolan's really capitalized on.
Yes, and just if for people who haven't read the story, why is he, if he is making it up, which you could, oh, it's funny that making up a giant one-eyed monster and all these other, because he leaves Troy with 600 men. In fact, if I just quote what we heard at the top from that trailer, we hear Matt Damon, who's playing Odysseus, say, "No one could stand between my men and home, not even me." Well, the statistics don't quite bear that out, because he started with 600 men and he gets home with, let me just check notes, none of them. So is it just he's just doing this in order that he can get home?
Well, I mean, I think it's a slightly cynical way of looking at the story, but I mean, I think it doesn't reflect well on him as a leader, does it, to lose all of your men? But what he says is, along the way, this wasn't all his fault. I mean, he's come up against the most impossible situation. I mean, the Cyclops gobbles up a load of his men. He's lucky to escape from his clutches. There are lots and lots of disasters at sea. Everything along the way is invented just to make their journey more difficult. And he is the only survivor, but he has to be, for the narrative, he has to be the only survivor. It's just the way it works out. It's kind of this very kind of perfect ending with this reunion with his wife. And it's all the more powerful that he is the only survivor. But as you say, it does not reflect very well on him. And I think the difficulty with his journey is, I mean, he has come up against everything, but he finally lands on this island, which looks really jolly nice. And these people, the Phaeacians, are seemingly, you know, quite trustworthy compared to all the other people he's come across. And they are feasibly in a position to sail him home. And what he discovers when he lands among them is that they absolutely love stories. So they have a poet who performs stories at their court. And he's telling all kinds of stories about the Trojan War, in which Odysseus himself has fought. So Odysseus is then there to entertain them. He knows what they like. They all absolutely adore stories. So he joins them and launches into this fantastic sort of array of different myths and stories, which he presents as very much, what he's actually lived through, what he's survived.
Well, it's funny you say that, because, and you mentioned the idea of unreliable narration. I read a really interesting piece quite a long while ago about comparing the way Odysseus tells the stories, just like you described, to, I don't know if listeners have seen The Usual Suspects, but the way Verbal Kint, played by Kevin Spacey in that film, sort of weaves a narrative as he needs to, as the story progresses. And that this is quite a sort of a long-standing trick in storytelling. So is this the first time this was ever done by Homer?
I think so. I mean, it's very difficult for us to judge what happened before him. And what we can probably say is that quite a lot of the characters within this poem were probably already known to the first audiences of Homer. And I'm saying audiences because this poem was initially performed, it was sung, and people listened to it rather than read it. So we're talking sort of 8th century BC, really, really early. So it's very difficult for us to know exactly what was happening before then. But they might well have been familiar with the Cyclops and had some expectation, for example, of what he was like. So, you know, possibly Odysseus is kind of giving them what people have already heard. You know, he's giving them what they want to hear because they know a little bit about this mythological world that Homer gives us in full. So I think, I mean, it's a really interesting concept that you have this man who's potentially, you know, quite a slippery character. He's potentially playing with what people know, but also making stuff up.
And just finally, Daisy, then, because the classical world created so many stories that many of us know today, and indeed many that have been lost, but this one always seems to sit at the top of the pile. What is it about the Odyssey that makes it so timeless and will have attracted Christopher Nolan, and why we're talking about it right now?
Well, it's a survivor story. You know, it has a happy ending. We like that. We're following this man. We care very deeply about him because he's complex and he's also very flawed. I mean, he's a hero on the one hand, but he also has a lot of flaws as well. So I think he's quite humanized. You can relate to him. He's on this ultimate quest. And it is, you know, it has elements, the kind of boy's own story to it. It really is really quite sort of, you know, racy as the story goes, with all these sort of wonderful characters he meets along the way. So I think it just captures our imagination from childhood onwards.
Well, I am totally with you. I cannot wait for 17th of July 2026 to see it in IMAX. I will be there in the queue. Thank you so much for your insights on the Odyssey. That's classicist Daisy Dunn. Coming up in the next half an hour, the question everyone's asking this season, is it flu or is it COVID? Our resident GP will tell us next. Now the news with Daryl Jackson.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Times Radio News headlines, it is 2:30. After months of protests, ministers have announced changes to inheritance tax thresholds for farmers and businesses. A 20% levy on agricultural land and businesses worth £1 million was due to come into force from April. Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds says they've listened and made changes.
We want to protect more family farms and businesses, so we're announcing today that we're increasing the inheritance tax threshold for individuals from £1 million to £2.5 million. So that means a couple with an estate worth up to £5 million will pay no inheritance tax when they pass on their estate.
Two Islamic State supporters have been found guilty of planning what police say could have been Britain's most deadly gun attack on Jewish targets in Manchester. Walid Sadawi and Amar Hussein tried to smuggle weapons into the UK, but their plot was exposed by an undercover operative. A man's declined to enter a plea after being charged with drugging and raping his ex-wife over a 13-year period. Philip Young, who's formerly from Swindon, is accused of 56 offences and will next appear in court in January. And the US Department of Justice has released its latest batch of files linked to Jeffrey Epstein, with around 11,000 documents made public. Among them are emails between Ghislaine Maxwell and an unidentified man signing off as A, using an address described as the Invisible Man. In one message, the writer says he's at Balmoral during the royal family's summer stay, prompting renewed speculation about his identity. US officials have stressed the material doesn't prove wrongdoing by anyone who's been named. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. obviously.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It's 2:33 and this is John Harvey. Now, coming up at 4, John Pienaar will be taking over with Drive, and he's here now to tell us what's on the show. Hello, John.
Hi, John. Well, look, the U-turn on farmers and the farms and inheritance tax, that just came out of the blue, just popped up in a written press release, which was a curious way to announce such a major announcement. After many, many months, last budget but one, remember, they took this decision, which always seemed, well, very quickly seemed to be a misjudgment. The tractors on the streets, the farmers with loads of public support. And then they make the big U-turn, which has got the NFU almost happy for the NFU. And it slips out so quietly, which is, you know, obviously the announcement is interesting. It may have bought themselves or regained just a bit of credit. It's just curious to do it that way. There's a Machiavellian principle, which is if you're going to make a concession, make a big deal out of it. Make yourself look generous.
And they just had an opportunity to do that at the budget.
And he just popped out a little press release. However, to an extent, they sort of maybe seen off the next tractor protest in Whitehall. So we'll talk about that. And I'll talk to the National Farmers Union president, Tom Bradshaw. Also in the programme, going to be, well, the Epstein files are pouring out pretty much as I speak. There's more. Well, of course, there's more in there, including more about President Trump. Mm-hmm. There's more photos, more references to the man who used to be the prince. And we're going to trawl through some of that and taking in some of the other examples of President Trump's, you know, galactic ego, the announcing of a new generation of warships. Trump class, they're going to be called.
Yes.
And that's now become normal in this not very normal world after the renaming of the Kennedy Center, named after that revered great president. Now it's the Trump Kennedy Center. I'm going to be talking about that too. And later on, we got Tim Marshall, one of my favorite foreign affairs commentators on the program, open for questions there as we look back on the year and peer a bit forward, and Christmas crackers. There is such a thing as a Christmas cracker company, which sits around where people, hand-chosen people, sit around in a circle and dream up jokes in a committee. I mean, I thought jokes, the Christmas cracker jokes, were just dad's jokes, which were terrible. And I've learned now, in looking into this story, there is a purpose to them being so terrible. It is actually a positive one. It is about getting the family all groaning together. I just thought they were terrible, and that's it.
There is method in the madness of a Christmas
cracker.
It's like
Monopoly, right? And around the family table.
Yes.
The point is to get people angry and falling out and turning over the table, all part of the Christmas fun.
Well, it's same with an EastEnders Christmas special, isn't it? Get angry or event through something else.
Yes.
So,
respect for Christmas crackers.
Absolutely.
But I'm going to have a comedian and someone from the company who's in the process now of putting the last of the jokes together.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, lots to look forward to, including maybe some real groaners there. That's John Pienaar, who's taking over at 4. Now, at this time of year, it's traditional to look back at the great and the good who we've lost over the last 12 months. And for the last 10 years, one artist has come up with a creative, poignant and wildly successful style of commemoration. Chris Barker is the brilliant brain behind the annual obituary montage done in the style of the Sgt. Pepper album cover, which you may well have seen going viral online. Just last week, he released his 10th and final image. And he joins me now to talk about the project, why he's stopping and why people love it so much. Hello, Chris.
Hi, John. Merry Christmas. How are you?
Merry Christmas. I'm good, thanks. It's lovely to chat to you. And now, we've got to know each other through your montages, and I have been a huge fan of them since you started. So first up, for listeners who haven't seen your work, paint a picture for us how you had the idea originally.
Back in 2016, I have told this story so many times.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If I sound like I'm on autopilot, I'm not. Back in 2016, do you remember 2016? Might need a trigger warning for this. There was Brexit, there was Bowie dying, and then there was Trump got elected, you know, unexpectedly. Well, for me anyway, I was sitting up waiting to watch America elect its first female president, and then suddenly it all started to go a bit 2016, you know. And I thought, I'll get my thoughts down on paper and try and do an image that sums up this really unusual year that we were all experiencing. And it wasn't originally supposed to be a Sgt. Pepper. It wasn't originally just going to be a montage of all the celebrities who died that year. But then what with one thing and another, that's what it ended up being. And I posted it online. I didn't expect to get much much reaction about it. I certainly didn't still expect to be talking about it on the radio 10 years later. it was huge. And then obviously, because I'd posted it sort of mid-November, there was still quite a lot of the year to go.
Yes.
And I couldn't just let it sort of sit there and do its thing. I had to keep updating it. There was Leonard Cohen, there was Robert Vaughan, and then as the year went on, there was George Michael on Christmas Day, and then there was Carrie Fisher just after that. And it became a part of the way people experienced that strange phenomenon in that year where everybody who was great and good seemed to be passing away in rapid succession. So it sort of became part of the story. And then I vowed never to do it again and then did it again, foolishly, because the next year that you had Roger Moore and Adam West and John Hurt, you know, and I thought, but at that point I thought I'd try and use it to tell another story. So I tried to tell the story about climate change and what have you. And in subsequent, and I've carried on every year trying to get a story across as well as doing this montage. If you look at them all now, which you can do in my book, look at them all now, it tells the story of the last 10 years in quite an interesting way, actually.
So I wanted to ask you about that because you've got a book out and also you exhibited the prints last week in London. And that's true. It, as you say, it's completely by accident that they do tell quite the tale over the last decade. And tell us about how you've managed to sort of navigate the sort of peaks and troughs. Because, for example, in 2020, you had to find a way to sort of cover COVID. And so there's a very unique aspect to that one, isn't there?
Exactly. Yeah. It has coincidentally covered a really sort of monumental decade. You know, we've had Brexit, we've had COVID, we've had, you know, for example, in 2020, when we were all locked down and working from home and what have you, I had a bit of time on my hands, as you can imagine. So I thought, well, the logical thing to do here is to have everyone wearing surgical masks, which made my job a lot harder because you can't recognize people as easily when half their face is obscured. So the costumes and the props and the sort of the iconic image had to do a lot more work than it would normally. And I think it's quite interesting, actually. If you look at them, you can still tell who most people are. I mean, it helps that people like Maradona is wearing like an Argentinian face mask, or, you know, so, where necessary, I've included clues on the mask as well. But yeah, and then so the following year, for example, because we'd come out of lockdown on the whole the following year. So I had all the masks sort of strewn on the floor in front of them, which was, again, a pretty iconic image for 2021 of seeing a mask in the mud on the floor, you know. When we looked at them on the wall at the exhibition last week, it's actually the first time I've seen them, all of them at that size, up displayed like that. And it's a shame that the exhibition wasn't on for longer, actually, because it really did. I think that's how they should have been seen, really. Or in a book, of course. Sorry, John.
No, not at all. Which is available online. But part of the poignancy of the book is that you've decided to draw a line under the project now, that this year's montage, which came out last week, is your last one. So why is it that you've stopped?
Well, I mean, it is the last one, but I will be doing an update to it because sadly there have been a few additions since then. You know, it was primarily Chris Rea, obviously, which is a very, very poignant, almost as poignant when someone who's involved with, who's so linked to Christmas dies at this time of year, it has that sort of extra poignancy, like George Michael with Last Christmas dying on Christmas, the announcement being on Christmas Day, Chris Rea. So, I've decided to draw a line under it this year because as much fun as it has been to do it, it has been 10 years, you know, and I'm going to stop it at some point is what I was thinking. And you don't stop something after 11 years, do you? You stop it after a nice round number. There are lots of reasons why I'm stopping doing it this year. I mean, the fact that So, you know, the age of the people that I'm including is getting closer to my age. You know, that's quite a scary sort of mortality indicator there. I don't really want to end up doing the sort of the Britpop years version. It was bad enough having to put Manny in from the Stone Roses this year.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yes, I know. And so there is another big reason why I'm sort of drawing it to a close. I think that, you know, the audience has become a lot more polarized. People always, you've probably seen it. I know you follow the thing, but, you know, the minute I posted it on Blue Sky, someone's in there going, where's John Badley? Where's some names I've never heard of. Where's Bob Uecker, Wink Martindale and James Carter Cathcart? I'll let you know if I think of more names, but I doubt you add them. Actually, scrap that, he said. I'll do extra cutouts and you can decide where to include them.
Right.
It's not your blog, mate. You know, it's not, this is my piece, really. But people have become sort of polarized. There are a lot of people complaining that I included, say, Charlie Kirk, Dick Cheney, Norman Tebbit, James Whale. So on that side of the equation, and then also people on the other side saying they were disappointed that I'd included Rob Reiner, which came as a bit of a surprise. You know, you can't please everybody. I think people they're too divided. I can't be thinking so hard about how to please everybody with the piece of work. You know, it started off as just a sort of a broad brushstrokes view of the year. But as time's gone on, I've had to become sort of more inclusive, I've included people from all sorts of walks of life. Back in 2016, it was really only people who are instantly visually recognizable from media or music or art or what have you. But now I'm down to the nitty gritty of, you know, I can't possibly actually use an example of someone because everyone's important. But, you know, I've got to the point now where the number of people on this year's montage is over double what the number that was on the first one.
Wow.
And it is, I think it's like about 35 more than the previous highest number of people included on it.
Gosh.
It's becoming more of a data wrangling exercise, piece of art.
Yes.
Know.
Yeah. It's funny. It's maybe it's also in itself, your story is something, it tells the tale of social media from something which was, I'd say, more celebratory and poignant to now. It's just so much more of a sort of a battlefield, as it were. Maybe next year's one just needs to be an empty Sgt. Pepper's montage, just with one of your montages on it.
Demonstrate. As people have said before, what you're doing next year, the White Album. Yeah.
Yes. Well, there we are. So we'll just very finally, in a few seconds, you're going to have some time on your hands next year. So what's next, Chris? Because you've got such a creative brain, and I'm all ears as to what you might be doing with your talent.
Well, firstly, I'll be sending out all the books. I've got to finish doing the book, which is available on chrisbarkerprints.co.uk. And so I'll be mailing all of those out. I'm working on a project with David Quantick about lost movies of Hollywood, it's called. We did a calendar this year, which proved really popular, and we think we're going to do a full book of it. So that's first on the list. I'll think of something else, John. I like to keep busy.
Well, I've seen that calendar. I have to say, if people can find that, your work with David on just give us a flavour of one of the sort of movie posters you've come up with, because they're very funny. Well,
the concept is that modern movies that you know now are actually remakes of movies from the past. So, for example, K-pop Demon Hunters, first one that sprung to mind there. Is in our fictional world is a remake of a Cliff Richard movie where he and the gang and Eunice Stubbs and Melvin Hayes or whatever travel to Korea to battle demons while secretly on a tour. But I've also done Die Hard was a remake of a Norman Wisdom movie. where he has to protect Grimsdale's department store from terrorists. The Men in Black was an Abbott and Costello.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
It's stuff like that. And David's written a lovely synopsis on each one, and we've done the artwork in the style of the poster from that era. So hopefully that should prove popular.
Oh, great. Yes. Well,
that idea could run and run.
It could run and run. And terrifyingly, I can imagine AI creating them in a matter of seconds.
Well,
thank you so much. Congratulations on 10 years of marking obituaries in such a creative and brilliant way. It's a wonderful project. And I do encourage listeners to check it out online. If you can, that's the brilliant artist and designer, Chris Barker. Coming up, our resident GP will update us on the latest health news. It's 2:48 and you're listening to John Harvey on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. A well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Christmas on Times Radio.
It's 10 to 3 and this is John Harvey. And now it's the point in the show when we talk health. And for our first story, it's been announced today that the US food regulator has approved a pill version of the weight loss jab Wegovy. Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast, and she joins us now. Hello, Rachel.
Good afternoon.
Well, look, this is a real first, is it not? A pill form of weight loss drug. Is this a sort of magic pill we've always believed didn't exist, or is it a bit more complicated than that?
Well, we've obviously seen huge progress over the last few years with weight loss medication, but to now, most of the medication that have been available have been injection form, and we're thinking of things like Mounjaro, Ozempic, you know, commonly used names now. Now, those drugs, which are called GLP-1 agonists, are now available in tablet form. So in fact, in the UK, we're actually already using those drugs in tablet form for use in type 2 diabetes. But the US is now the first to license the oral form for weight loss. And I suspect it will follow that pattern in the UK as well. I mean, we have had weight loss tablets in the past. They certainly have not been as effective. This is the first time that anything has been licensed that is oral for more than a decade. So yeah, I think this is going to be very interesting as it rolls out and when we see it in the UK.
And has this development come round quicker than we expected it to happen? And also, when you talk about licensing in the UK, are there issues around the dosage for an oral version of the drug? Because if I'm right, the milligrams in an injection are a lot smaller than an oral version. Are there any problems that still need to be encountered with that?
So, we have to have our own licensing rules nationally, of course. And I think it's absolutely correct that we go through our own due process in the UK. We have a very different way of using drugs and selling drugs in the UK. So that needs to be reviewed under our standards. Now, No, it's very normal for drugs which are injectable and then oral to be different doses. And really, it's not something you should make a direct comparison for. They enter the body very, very differently. They are metabolized very differently in process. So we do need different doses through different routes of entry. So that's not something to be kind of concerned about. Of course, as doctors, we need to know the different dosing regimens for different formats of drugs, but that's pretty standard for different forms.
Okay, well, let's move on to a different story. Here in the UK, the resident doctors' five-day strike concluded yesterday. So the walkout's over, Rachel. What have you heard about how it went, the impact it caused, and any backlogs heading into, of course, the Christmas period?
So I'll be really honest and say at this time of year, whenever I am phoning the hospital to refer a patient in, you know, that would be in a kind of an urgent setting. It is, I cannot remember a winter where they've said, yeah, great, we've got lots of space, we're not very busy. It just doesn't happen. So really, when we were, you know, referring patients in last week over the five-day strike, didn't, from our perspective as GPs, feel particularly different, because we know it is always busy. Mm-hmm. We know that people always wait a long time in A&E. Have I come across any, haven't heard of any patients in my area who, for example, have had operations cancelled, etc. I believe that did happen. I haven't personally come across somebody who has explained that was the case for them. I'm sure there was a huge impact on those who were covering the work. So people who either chose not to strike, or people, seniors who were covering their juniors. I'm sure it was a very, very busy 5-day period already, when it's incredibly busy during winter and during a busy flu season. But, you know, I hope now that the people that were really covering over those days do have a bit of downtime over Christmas. I know that any junior doctors that I speak to, you know, are incredibly grateful for their seniors who cover them during these periods. And now we're back to the usual, you know, busy time at Christmas, where it's all hands on deck. And, you know, the junior doctors are in full swing working over that period.
So is it true to say that because this time of year is just so busy, that from your perspective, actually, to have just one extra aspect in the form of the strike adding to it, it's almost hard to equate what effect that did have, just because things are so madly busy in every hospital anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure statistically, I'm sure there is data out there that will look, you know, that will show whether there is a difference in, you know, times waited and discharge times, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not aware of that being out yet and showing the hard evidence. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The feeling really is at this time of year that it is so busy anyway. You know, whenever I ask a patient, you know, advise, for example, that they go to A&E at the moment, they just wince with the thought of what that's going to be like. And that has been for many weeks. That has not been over the last 5 days during the strike. That is a winter issue that we have seen for many years.
Yes, well, speaking of winter issues, I must ask you about, obviously, the super flu that is currently circulating, and I'm sure many listeners have either suffered from or know people who have. The new strain is officially H3N2, and that's been presenting the NHS with another tidal wave of illness, according to health bosses, and as on top of, is COVID and norovirus. Is it helpful to call this a super flu? Is this as unprecedented as we get told in the press, or is this just as we should expect now every winter, the NHS is going to be at breaking point just for obvious reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, it has been an early season, which has led to, you know, real challenges. We have seen the highest number of people in hospital with flu for this time in winter. However, it is still a bug which we know is benefited by being vaccinated. So it's not something that is unmanageable with the means that we have. It has been challenging because of the earliness of it. And I think also, you know, the fallout from kind of slightly poor vaccination rates that we've seen ever since COVID. So I think there's been a bit of a perfect storm coupled with some of the new characteristics from this strain that seems to be spreading very quickly. But ultimately, it is a flu bug. It's not completely completely different to flu that we've seen other years. It's still something which, you know, as we always say, get vaccinated, because that vaccine still will protect you.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because, I mean, any sort of a news hound will know of this sort of HXNY formula. So this is H3N2. And we never know, as sort of as punters, when we get our flu vaccination, if that's the one that's going into us. So just tell us from the medical standpoint, is it a predictor that experts have to work out which will be most prevalent? Or do we get some level of vaccination and protection against all strains? How does it work?
So there's going to be that baseline protection with the vaccine, and then the vaccine gets tweaked every year. If you remember during COVID, there was constant tweaking of the vaccines, and there continues to be, to kind of match the virus's mutations. But what we do also is that we look at the patterns from Australia, because they have winter before us, and we look at what they've experienced, and we can base some of their experience on what we need in our vaccine. So we have that data. Yes, there is an element that we never know 100% how effective that vaccine will be. But every single year, it does offer protection. It's just, you know, that exact figure is something that we only really fully know when we're well into the flu season.
And just in 10 seconds, if you can, Rachel, at what point should someone see a doctor, or they should just sort of sit it out at home and get on the Lemsips?
So I would say, have a look on the NHS website, 111 website. If you are really struggling, it gives very clear advice as to when you need to seek medical attention. But particularly if you are frail or very young or elderly, look at those signs for whether you need help, because there's multiple factors.
Well, thank you so much for that advice, and I hope our listeners, I'm sure, will take that on board. That is our GP, Rachel Ward, and she's the co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. I'm John Harvey, and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up in this hour, Trump says he's still got Greenland on his Christmas list. We'll work out just how likely he is to receive it. What if this time of year leaves you feeling a bit lonely? Well, you're not alone, and psychotherapist Julia Samuel will give us some tips on how to cope. And we'll speak to historian Bob Nicholson to ask, did the Victorians make or break Christmas as we know it? First, the news with Daryl Jackson.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Ministers are going to raise the inheritance tax relief threshold for farmers. It's going up from £1 million to £2.5 million following months of protest. The Times policy editor Oliver Wright says it is a significant climb down by the government.
In effect, it means that if a farmer has a spouse or a civil partner, they can pass on to their children a family farm worth up to £5 million without paying any inheritance tax at all. Well, that is a doubling from the £2.5 million that it was before. It's a strange announcement. I mean, they've slipped it out shortly before Christmas without any fanfare.
Two Islamic State supporters have been found guilty of planning what police say could have been Britain's most deadly gun attack on Jewish targets in Manchester. Waleed Sadawi and Amar Hussein tried to smuggle weapons into the UK, but their plot was exposed by an undercover operative. Mark Gardner heads the Community Security Trust, which protects Jewish communities.
To hear and know that somebody was trying to obtain weapons, that somebody had put together a meticulous attack plan to go and kill as many Jews as possible. To hear that, I think, will make people very, very fearful.
Five men accused of sexual offences against a woman have been released on conditional bail. Joanne Young's ex-husband, Philip, was remanded in custody earlier, alleged to have drugged and raped her over a 13-year period. The other men will attend a further hearing at Swindon Crown Court next month. Tens of thousands of pages of files about the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein have been unsealed. The US Justice Department's also issued a statement saying they contain untrue and sensationalist claims about Donald Trump. The batch includes an email sent by someone signing off as A at Balmoral, asking Ghislaine Maxwell for new inappropriate friends. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and Mr. Trump have always denied wrongdoing. Jack Royston, Newsweek's chief royal correspondent, has told Times Radio this could be difficult for the royal family.
Obviously, we don't have definitive, unambiguous confirmation that the A who signed off these emails was A for Andrew. It's very difficult to believe, though, reading through them, that they are not talking about him. You know, there's references to a valet passing away. He talks about royal summer camp at Balmoral. Balmoral is not a generally public or open place.
A two-year-old boy from London has died after a broken-down car was hit by another vehicle on the A1 near Peterborough. Five others were seriously injured on Saturday evening. A man has been arrested. And Greta Thunberg's been arrested at a protest in support of Palestine Action members who are on hunger strike in prison. The climate activist has been detained for displaying a placard in support of a proscribed terror organisation. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, it's 4 minutes past three. I'm John Harvey and I'm with you till 4pm with the very best in news, features, culture and comment until I pass the baton on to John Pienaar for Drive. We've been lighting the fuse for each hour with a deeper cut from the festive music jukebox, and that one really is a standout. Sir Christopher Lee with his unlikely heavy metal banger Jingle Hell from 2013. I hope that's not summing up your Christmas preparations at home as you get ready for the big day. Coming up between now and four, are the Americans getting serious about taking over Greenland? And what could this mean in 2026? Leading psychotherapist Julia Samuel will talk to me about loneliness at Christmas, coping, supporting, and why there's such pressure around this one day. And in our big interview, historian Dr. Bob Nicholson will be talking through all the huge ways that the Victorians invented Christmas as we know it. On which note, do you have festive fatigue? Is there one aspect of Christmas you'd gladly erase if you had the chance? Well, you've got one more hour to vent your spleen with our virtual amnesty. We've had a few in recently. Frank says I'd ban Christmas music in shops until December the 6th. Well, a certain politician by the name of Count Binfield agrees entirely. In fact, says goes further. Any shop that plays Christmas music before that point should be closed down and turned into a public library. Hear, hear to that, I say. Meanwhile, Mike has been in touch to say Christmas rituals fit for the bin. Easy. Get rid of Secret Santa. Who came up with this idea? They should be identified and ridiculed without mercy. Well, we don't know. Do you know? Well, if you've got a bete noire you'd like to throw out with the wrapping paper, get in touch in any of the usual ways. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. You can text us 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. Now, though, Donald Trump has caused controversy once again. How many times has that statement been said this year? And this time it's with the appointment of Jeff Landry to the volunteer post of special envoy to Greenland. In a speech yesterday, the president said the US, quote, has to have Greenland. Well, Magnus Land Nielsen, EU politics reporter at Euractiv, joins me now to talk about this. Hello, Magnus.
Hello. Lovely to have you. Lovely of you to have me.
Indeed. Well, it is lovely to have you. Magnus, this is reigniting a fierce debate from the sort of start of Trump 2.0. How has the new remarks gone down in Denmark?
Well, in Denmark and Greenland alike, I think this is reigniting some anxiousness that was spawned earlier this year, or actually ultimately late last year already, when Trump refloated his wish to acquire Greenland. We have to recall that this is actually something that he mentioned years ago, already during his first term. And now in Copenhagen, as well as in Nuuk, the Greenlandic capital, people are I think facepalming more than anything. But they're also, I think they're anxious because this is This is very unbecoming, I think, that most Greenlanders and Danes alike find.
Yes, clearly that there is, they are taking it seriously because the Danish Prime Minister has summoned the US ambassador. So you mentioned the face palming, and I'm sure Denmark, as so many countries and Greenland, will want to try and tiptoe around the Trump administration as much as they can. But could this escalate in the new year?
I mean, I think I think the way this has been taken down across the Danish realm has been that this is Trump essentially acknowledging or thinking anyway that not enough is happening. And so that's why he's appointed this special envoy, the governor of Louisiana, who he's taking up this volunteer position to push things forward. It's kind of interesting because already Trump has appointed one of his loyal men, one of the president's men in Ken Hovery, the new U.S. ambassador to Denmark. With, well, we have to imagine having kind of, well, he's there to do the same thing, essentially, right? To bring Greenland closer to the U.S. Green Hovery, the new U.S. ambassador, was in Nuuk in Greenland, meeting with the Greenlandic government a few weeks ago only, where he allegedly said, and he also said that also on camera, but also behind closed doors, that the Americans do respect the Greenlanders' right to self-determination. And the Greenlanders have said, also, just within the last couple of days, time and again, that they have absolutely no wish to become Americans. They have no wish to be Danes either. Down the line, they obviously want to be an independent state in their own right.
Yes, well, you've preempted my next question, because I wanted to ask you about Greenlanders and self-determination, because clearly it does look like an anachronism for it to be a dependency of any country. It's so far away from Denmark. And when you talk about one day perhaps, you know, having self-determination, is there any sense of when Greenlanders think or indeed would want that to be? Has it got that far, or is it very much a theoretical debate?
No, it's not so much a theoretical debate as it's a wish that most Greenlanders, the majority of Greenlanders, have. Like, they do want their country to be independent. And then the question then becomes, like, at what pace do we get there? The Greenlandic political cycle, and I think this is an interesting point, has fallen kind of fortunately compared to things in Washington, because there was a Greenlandic election to the Greenlandic parliament in the spring. So you have to imagine you had just had the initial push from the second Trump administration to acquire Greenland, and they were scared, I think is the right word to choose here. And so they also elected largely politicians who, well, they are still pro-independent, but they probably have a bit more pragmatic approach, the current government, the current leader, especially of the Greenlandic government, than many other personalities you would find in the Greenlandic political scene.
So if we were to imagine the Greenlanders moving towards self-determination, is it more likely than anything that the Americans would seek a sort of soft power route towards getting influence in that region by having a sympathetic Greenlander government? Is that the most likely route that the Americans would take? Because obviously the other version of this seems unconscionable, that they would do anything by force.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that I've been to Greenland myself a few times. As many Danes, I have family in Greenland, and when I talk to people there, we struggle to find out what is the end goal here, because, well, he says he wants for the minerals, well, he can come and dig the minerals. The Greenlanders are very welcoming of that. The Greenlandic subsoil is a prerogative of the Greenlandic self-rule, so they can do as they please, the Greenlanders. If it's a question of military presence, well, the defense agreement with the Danes say that they can essentially build as many bases as they want. They used to have countless bases there. Now they only have one, and that is, I have to again emphasize, that's a choice the Americans made. It's not something that Greenlanders had them do, or it's not something that the Danes had them do.
So if you're saying that the current agreements allow the Americans the strategic advantage they might want, what do you think that is behind the Trump administration's stance? Is this a prestige thing? As you say, he's been talking about Greenland for a long time. What, in your analysis, is driving this?
But you're taking the words out of my mouth, John, because that is exactly what the conclusion you end up with is that if this is not about minerals and is not about military presence, then ultimately this is probably just having the colors of Greenland on a world map colored in the same colors as the United States, right? You just want it for the prestige, essentially, as you say. I think that's at least the impression that many Greenlanders and Danes and frankly also Europeans alike are left with.
Well, just finally, I hope this is not true, but one thing I think about it all feels like a sort of horrible game of risk that we're in with this world of strongman politics. And can you see a world in which, obviously, NATO is at the heart of this, and Denmark and the US are allies, and for America to have this stance on Greenland is potentially going to drive a wedge in the alliance. Is there a world in which Trump could potentially use Greenland as a bargaining chip in order to maintain American membership of NATO? I mean, is that a worst case scenario? Can you see it happening?
Actually, I haven't heard that idea floated before. I think this is ultimately the Trump administration reinventing or revisiting the Monroe Doctrine, as many way more clever people than I have said before as well. And that's also, by the way, what the new U.S. Special Envoy to Greenland said on Twitter just today, that this is a part of the Americans reclaiming dominance in the Western Hemisphere. Whether it's going to be a bargaining chip for them to stay in NATO, we'll have to wait and see. I guess the Europeans and sort of my day job is covering European politics are doing everything they can to step up the European presence and self-reliance independence in the realm of defense, so we don't have to be as reliant on the Americans as we have been for the past 8 years. Whether it's a hill that Donald Trump is ready to die on to claim Greenland and maybe by that essentially killing the transatlantic alliance, I doubt it. And also, I think one thing that maybe it's just me coping more than anything, but there's also midterms coming up in a year. And this is, I have to underline, without being an expert in U.S. politics, this is not exactly a selling point in U.S. politics. This is not something that enjoys large popular support in the broader U.S. population.
Okay, well, just finally, I just want to put to you a question that we've had via text from a listener, Chris. And he says, Magnus, he said, is it that Greenland would be unable to support itself as an independent country? And says that it'd be easy to support that with an online search. What's your view on that? If Greenland wanted to be a self-determining country, that it would actually have the ability to do that?
I think, first of all, I had to preface my answer to that, saying that I'm a Dane, and so any opinion I have about the future of Greenland is really kind of irrelevant. I think most Danes also appreciate that this is indeed a question for the Greenlanders themselves. I think what Greenlanders and also what the most ardent pro-independence politicians in Greenland are in favor of is what you call sort of a free association agreement, where it's something similar to New Zealand have with the Cook Islands, where the Cook Islands is an independent nation in its own right, but some services in the public sector, be it health or education, it could be defense as well, and maybe foreign policy, they can sort of outsource to the New Zealand government when they so please. And so, in that sense, it could be an independent country. But I think also that Greenlanders themselves also appreciate that being a completely self-sustainable economy with 50,000 people living on an area that's about four times the size of France is probably not sustainable, at least in the medium to short term.
Okay, well, thank you for all of that and for responding to the listener's question there and for your insight into what could be an international flashpoint in 2026. That was Magnus Land-Nielsen, EU politics reporter at Euractiv. It's 3:16. You're listening to John Harvey on Times Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking to psychotherapist Julia Samuel about loneliness at Christmas. So don't go away.
Tom Noonan here, inviting you to join Times Radio for Christmas. From 1 o'clock, sit down for lunch with The Times' Jack Blackburn, Charlotte Ivers and wine columnist Will Lyons for good conversation and some even better drink. Then listen live to The King's Speech at 3 o'clock. From 5, The Letters editor Andrew Riley will be talking me through some of his favourite submissions from readers over the last year. And then The Sunday Times' literary and deputy literary editors Robbie Millen and Laura Hackett go through their books of the year.
Christmas Day on Times Radio. This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
Right. Brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
End 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op, Group Food Stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
This is Times Radio.
It's 3:18 and this is John Harvey. Now, for those of us who will be spending the Christmas season alone, the expectation to be around loved ones can heighten feelings of loneliness. If you're feeling isolated and cut off from celebrations, it's an experience shared by people across the country. I'm joined now by psychotherapist Julia Samuel to discuss how to deal with loneliness at Christmas. Hello, Julia.
Nice to speak to you.
Yes, you too. And this is such an important issue at this time of year, especially. So just to begin with, what kind of experiences do your patients who struggle with this share with you?
So I think what's difficult about Christmas is that there's this gap between what we may have remembered it of Christmas's past, which were happy, and the present where we feel much lonelier. And this gap between, it isn't just about being simply alone, it's a subjective gap between the connections we have and what we believe we should have. Because you sort of don't remember ordinary Octobers and Novembers, but you do particularly remember Christmas. So it's a very heightened sense of loneliness. And also this false kind of picture of everyone else is having their perfect Christmas, like a movie, which of course then nobody is, but there's this perception that that's happening.
And does the stigma of Christmas, as you say, exacerbate this to an extent that patients struggle to even talk to an expert like you about? Do you find you have to sort of tease this out of people, that it's almost an embarrassment that loneliness at Christmas causes?
I think there is a real sense of shame that there's, what's wrong with me? There must be something wrong with me, that I'm alone at Christmas. You know, is it something that I'm not liked? I can't make friends. But actually, often it's to do with external things that have happened. Like, you may be bereaved, your kind of primary person that you loved, your spouse, your parent has died, or maybe you've been relocated. You may have health and mobility issues. You know, there are so many issues that you don't have control of, but you can still kind of turn the critical voice against yourself. And I think that's the bit that you're talking about, is that you can have what I call a shitty committee, that is this kind of, it can be very loud or quite contaminatingly quiet, kind of turning against yourself at the time you actually most need to be kind to yourself and compassionate.
Well, from that then, what advice would you give to people? Because, I mean, there's a very good chance people will be listening to this right now who'll be having to spend the Christmas period on their own. So what advice would you give to people who might be worried about this and sort of entering what could be a bleak period?
Yeah, and just to add to the bleak period, of course, that there is this sort of shutdown, isn't there, which the whole of society effectively closes. All your normal structures of work and shops and habits and your micro connections of your barista, they disappear too. So it's, you're kind of left in this kind of bleak state. So I think, first of all, awareness that this isn't you not doing well, but this is a particularly difficult time of year. And recognizing not to criticize yourself, but to be kind to yourself, I think is a first step. And also being realistic that, you know, perfect Christmas is a marketing construct. It really doesn't exist. And I think, in that thing of turning to yourself, I think you can also turn against others and be very resentful. So do actions that, get your own needs met. Maybe be creative and schedule a video call, invite neighbours around, go to a film with someone else who's alone. Because I think when you're lonely, you can sort of feel, I'm not going to ask anybody to do anything, and you can go down that spiral. So to go out of your comfort zone and actually make an effort to connect and be with other people, I think can be really useful.
Well, on this subject, we've had a message in from Alex who, let me read this to you. He says, or she, they say, Christmas changes for people in different ways. For example, I have nobody to celebrate Christmas with, so there's no point decorating the house. My parents are gone, I have no siblings and no children. The few friends I have are either a long distance away or have their own family Christmas celebrations. I'm not looking for sympathy, but Christmas Day is no different to any other day for me. And I think that is redolent of a view that is in the country, that there are people who don't treat Christmas like the majority of us do. Some people they don't, as Alex said, they're not looking for sympathy. But is it incumbent on us, if we are lucky enough to be surrounded by loved ones, to think of those around us who are less fortunate? Or sometimes do we need to be careful whether people want their space protected? Is it a difficult line to balance?
I think you can only ask, if you know a neighbour's living alone that it is on their own, it would be nice to ask them in to come and have tea or join you. And, they have a perfectly good no that they can say. I wonder about the other things that can be really helpful, which, of course, is volunteering at Christmas. Because when we help others, it's as good for us as it is for the person that we help. We know that from research. And it allows us to feel useful and belong when we're part of something that's bigger than ourselves.
Yes, and I wonder, because you mentioned other times of year, and obviously this can, loneliness can, is not just a Christmas
issue. No, it's
issue.
Not one day, yeah.
No, well, quite right. So I just wanted to ask you, just to finish, does this need to be more of an open conversation throughout the year? That maybe Christmas is almost a misnomer, so it's leading us into, it's a bit of a red herring. This can be a constant issue.
Yeah, I mean, we know from research that loneliness is as bad for our health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, that we are wired for connection, and the sense of being excluded does us as much harm kind of in our brains as if we're being physically hurt. So it, from evolutionary reasons, we are wired to be tribal and connected and be part of a community. So if we feel exiled and outside of a community, what's awful is that you begin to develop these patterns that you withdraw more and more and more. Your self-esteem drops, your sense of identity, your belief in yourself, all of that shrinks. So it's a bigger kind of wall to overcome to get yourself to connect to others. And it's, and for what's changed is that many more young people, although they have lots of virtual connection, they have much less in-person, physiological, embodied connection. And many more young people are very lonely.
Well, thank you so much for shining a light, a very thoughtful light, on the importance of thinking for people and how they can cope at this this crucial time of year, and it not just being about this time of year. That's the psychotherapist, Julia Samuel. Now, back in April, I had the pleasure of sitting in for Jeff Norcott on Friday night, and I spoke to the brilliant writer Daniel Gray about his new book, Sunday Best, which is a homily to the day of rest, and it's called Travels Through the Day of Rest. And I began when I chatted to him, asking him about how he got started on this rather wonderful project.
It was one of those lockdown moments, of which we had so many, good and bad, when I just kept hearing people say, God, every day is like Sunday, and then probably singing it in a Morrissey-style voice as well. And it made me think, well, what do they mean by that? And getting that sense of aimlessness, essentially, is what they meant. And then getting that concept that Sunday has an identity. It's the one day of the week with a strong identity, whether good or bad. And I just started to think about that. Why did Sunday get its identity? What's the social history of Sunday? Was it just the church? What else made it be so different? And then a second thing happened is that I was working in Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides on a Sunday, and I thought, it is still Sunday here. It's taking me right back to childhood. And that's not in a disparaging way. It's a cultural thing. And this came together. And of course, with all my writing, the inevitable nostalgia, some of the greatest days of my life were my grandma's on a Sunday afternoon, greatest Yorkshire puddings on earth. And I'll have no argument with that. So a few things coming together like that and just wanting to travel around, really, and have a neb.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, I have to say, some parts of Britain these days, your Sunday afternoon is actually pretty much the same as, the height of Saturday afternoon on the high street these days. But I'm with you. And you say what makes a Sunday. I'm particularly interested in what makes a British Sunday, because I'm like you. I'm a real sucker for nostalgia. And you tap into that so wonderfully in the book. You know, that idea of television, the theme tunes, queuing bath time, that sudden dread of the looming week ahead. It's like a verbal time machine. And it sends me rushing back to like the early 90s. The sound of, if listeners can remember, Highway, Last of the Summer Wine, Antiques Roadshow, which wasn't prime time in those days, and of course the thought of unfinished homework. So I've got to ask you, and I feel guilty doing this now, especially because I'm filling my face with cheese and wine. Does Sunday have a unique power in this sense?
I think it definitely does, and you're right about that sense of losing, and that was another motivation to write the book, really, was just to go in search of Sunday and see what those differences, if they were still there, but nostalgia is the power of it all, and that's the nostalgia we all know plays a trick on us. So I thought early on I'd write about the sheer boredom in my village of on a Sunday back in the 90s and all of that, and those feelings you talk about, so as not to lose that fact. But what was heartening travelling around was finding that it is still there. You know, it was found in a car boot sale in Morpeth. I thought, this couldn't be any more Sunday. It wasn't just about, I went to church a couple of times, but even things, you know, being down in London and going to Speaker's Corner is a very, very Sunday-ish thing. So,
yes. Yeah,
it still has an identity, and it is rooted in nostalgia, no doubt about that.
But and history as well, because I love the fact that you don't just write about the sort of the wonders of recent history. You start the book with a chronology of Sunday history. Starts it right back to King Athelstan, arguably the first King of England, banning Sunday trading in the year 925.
Yeah, and you just can't. I couldn't believe that either when I started to research that side of it all. You know, we've well over 1,000 years of Sunday legislation, and there are great eccentricities in these laws as well. There's a time in 1571 where woolen hats had to be worn by men and boys on a Sunday, but it's the great little details. You know, that they're always trying to ban sport and activity through the years. In the 17th century, they realised they hadn't banned leaping and vaulting and jumping on a Sunday. You just think, was everyone jumping too much back then? I don't know. Brilliant. Yeah.
I take my hat off to you for being. I think you're the second historian, as far as I know, or writer to really alight on the importance of that year 925. After, of course, Professor Dolly Parton, who did get there first.
I really did.
That was the very talented author Daniel Gray on his magical new book Sunday Best. Coming up, did the Victorians make or break Christmas as we know it? But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Daryl Jackson.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, good afternoon. The National Farmers Union says many of its members will sleep more easily this Christmas after a government U-turn in inheritance tax. After months of protests, ministers have announced they'll raise the planned threshold from £1 million to £2.5 million. Tom Bradshaw is president of the NFU.
The Prime Minister and I met 10 days ago. We talked about the human impact of this policy, and along with the backbench pressure, I think it's really told that the government could not carry on without changing the policy. So we welcome the increase in the threshold. It will mitigate the impacts for many family farmers across the United Kingdom. And there'll be a lot of people that are able to sleep more easily this Christmas because of the changes that have been made.
Two Islamic State extremists have been found guilty of plotting a deadly gun attack on Manchester's Jewish community. The pair were found guilty by a jury at Preston Crown Court this afternoon. They bought assault rifles, handguns and ammunition for the suicide attack they planned on Jewish targets. Greater Manchester Police say the plan would have resulted in the deadliest terrorist attack in UK history. The US Department of Justice has released 30,000 more pages of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, but warned they contain unfounded and false claims about Donald Trump. The batch of files comes from federal investigations into the late paedophile. Among them is an email suggesting the now US president travelled on Epstein's private jet 8 times. Mr. Trump has always denied wrongdoing. And a man accused of drugging and raping his ex-wife has been remanded into custody. Philip Young, a 49-year-old former counsellor, has been charged with 56 offences against Joanne Young over a 13-year period. He didn't enter a plea at Swindon Crown Court. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Step inside our Hotel Chocolat cafes and experience the festive magic with our limited edition drinking chocolates crafted by our chocolatiers. Sink into the crisp, creamy notes of peppermint white or the delicate spices of mince pie. Topped with cocoa whip, the crowning glory. Light as air, intensely chocolatey. Oh, go on then. It is Christmas after all. Discover your new obsession only in Hotel Chocolat cafes.
My granddad says, the best Christmas gift isn't always something you can unwrap, like an investment with Aberdeen Investment Trust. I might not get excited about it now, but he says one day I might just realise how thoughtful it was. Something to help build my future. He says Aberdeen offer lots of investment opportunities, and he hopes I'll thank him when I grow up. Search Aberdeen Investment Trust to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital's at risk.
This is Times Radio.
It's 3:33. Remember to tune into Times Radio tomorrow for a great lineup of presenters. After Tom Noonan with Early Breakfast, it's Rosie Wright and Guto Harry from 6 with all the day's big stories. Hugo Rifkin will be here from 10, bringing the best of the Times to your ears. Then it's Jane Mulcairns with her view on life from 1, John Pienaar from 4 with Times Radio Drive. That's Christmas Eve here on Times Radio. Now, when Charles Dickens penned A Christmas Carol by candlelight in 1843, he surely could never have imagined the countless adaptations it would later inspire, from celebrated actors like Patrick Stewart and Jim Carrey to even more celebrated actors like the Muppets. You have to assume he'd be thrilled. Here's a clip from the 1951 adaptation.
You were always a good friend of mine. You will be visited by 3 spirits.
What? Was that the chance of hope that you mentioned, Jacob?
It was.
Well, in that case, never mind. I think I'd rather not.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first when the bell tolls 1.
But how much of our modern festive celebration is rooted in Victorian tradition? Well, it turns out rather a lot. I spoke to historian writer Dr. Bob Nicholson, and I started by asking him about the impact the Victorians have had on Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly popularised a lot of the traditions that we would now see as being an indispensable part of a modern Christmas. I think it's important to say that Christmas celebrations or even just like getting together around this time of year, you know, around the winter solstice, go back a long way, you know, way back to ancient Roman festivals of Saturnalia. But in the 19th century, yeah, the Victorians really embrace Christmas, I think, particularly in the early period of the 19th century. And yet there are loads of traditions now that we would not be without in our modern British Christmas that definitely begin in that period.
Well, let's wind the clock back to maybe before Victoria took the throne then, because part of your work is looking at how different it was before then. And actually, it wasn't, as you say, Christmas traditions or the end of year traditions go back thousands of years. But Christmas as we know it before Victoria, it was a smaller affair, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so if you go way back to, say, the medieval period, it would be quite a big festival then, but it would largely just be a festival focused on feasting and of course, with the religious ceremonies alongside of it. So all those additional things that we maybe associate with Christmas, like present giving, Christmas trees, crackers, all that stuff, yeah, you wouldn't have got that before the Victorian period. And certainly in the early decades of the 19th century, Christmas had kind of fallen out of fashion a bit. It was still being celebrated. It wasn't like it had completely disappeared and was unknown in the land, but it wasn't the kind of major national holiday that it is now. So the kind of rejuvenation of Christmas, turning it into, you know, the biggest festival of the year, is very much a thing that comes back into fashion in the Victorian era.
So is it true even that sort of shops would stay open at that time? You know, there wasn't such a holiday feeling. Like you say, there would have been feasting as such, but maybe was Easter even a more important religious festival at that time?
Yeah, certainly from a religious point of view. And I think in some ways, probably the church would maybe say it still is actually the more important than Christmas. But yeah, you mentioned about shops staying open. Yeah, traditionally, going back to the medieval period, people might have, you know, several sort of weeks even of feasting. But in that early 19th century, when kind of industrialization is kicking off, you know, there's a lot more kind of regimenting of time, people maybe would get a day off for Christmas, but maybe not even that, you know, if you were unlucky. So certainly the idea that this was a time when the commerce and the world grinds to a halt and we all just kind of switch off for a bit, that was going out of fashion in the early 19th century. And it was the Victorians, which of course the Victorian era doesn't start until 1837. It was just after that that people, I guess, started to re-embrace Christmas.
Well, I want to ask about both the factors that you mentioned there, that the royal family themselves, but also industrialization. And because, as you say, during the 19th century, there was improved transport, time got standardized, rising prosperity. Is there an element to which that the growth of Christmas was not just by design, but by accident too, that it was almost a byproduct of what was happening in the wider world?
Yeah, in many ways, you're absolutely right, because so many of the things that we associate with Christmas now, you know, need to be manufactured. They need to be mass produced. I mean, here's a good example, actually. That Christmas cards, maybe slightly going out of fashion now, but for a long time, a staple bit of Christmas traditions. Well, they only really become popular when you have a cheap penny post and the kind of the network, the logistics that you need behind all of that to be able to send, you know, lots of little pieces of paper and card out to millions of people around the country. And so the first Christmas card is in 1843. You know, that's the kind of when we first begin to embrace that as a Christmas tradition. And yeah, you needed the mass production of the card itself. It's not like these things were all perfectly hand-drawn. They were being printed. And so yeah, you need the technology behind it in order to really do Christmas at scale like that.
And as well as the technology when it comes to cards, was there anything in particular that sort of drove the popularity of that? Was that something that the royal family got behind? What apart from just the fact that you could send a card, sort of provoked people to do it?
Yeah, with cards, it's a slightly tricky one. I suppose it's when they become cheap enough to do it. And, you know, I guess it's replacing what would have previously just been a verbal Christmas greeting that you might give to someone that you meet. Now, suddenly, you can do it to people who are living, you know, further away and to send them, you know, a nice little object. You mentioned the royal family, though. They are definitely an important part of popularising Christmas traditions. The bigger one for them is the Christmas tree, which, again, we would now see has been an indispensable part of celebrating Christmas. Now, you go back, you know, pre-Victorian, it wasn't unusual for people to bring in bits of greenery to decorate the house at Christmas time, you know, holly wreaths and ivy and those kind of things. But yeah, the practice of bringing a tree into the house and decorating it, that was a Christmas tradition imported from Germany by Prince Albert and then really popularized by the royal family. So you would get images of them, you know, the young Victoria and her kids gathered around the Christmas tree, printed it in some of the most popular magazines and newspapers at the time. And that really does help to inspire people to think, well, if the royal family are doing it at that point, that meant it was fashionable and a really, you know, attractive and desirable thing to do. Yeah, it really takes off as, at least in part, as a result of their example.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating to think about to what extent the traditional British Christmas, as we think of it, was inspired by German tradition. And obviously that has so much to do with Prince Albert's influence. Is it possible that it's Albert's German heritage more than anything else, which was this put the rocket fuel under this, that if Queen Victoria had married an Englishman, that things might be different? Or how much is Albert the driver of all this?
Yes, he's certainly an influence, and the tree is a good example of that. I think, yeah, in some ways we maybe shouldn't overstate it too much, because there are the kind of Christmas traditions are a melting pot of so many different things. So you can kind of trace some of them back to, as we say, back to ancient Rome, back to pagan festivals, the whole kind of idea of Yule festivals or Yuletide and burning of a Yule log. That's more of a Viking thing. So in some ways, you know, Albert is just adding to that melting pot of cultural traditions that have been kind of swirling around for a very long time. But yeah, I think it's fair to say he's certainly an influence in shaping how the royal family celebrated it. And they then, of course, were an example for the rest of the country.
And I want to ask you, just while we stay on Albert, that, of course, he died, and his death during Victoria's reign was such a key sort of part of how her personality was showed itself through the latter half of her reign. Is there an element to which, therefore, Albert created a double boost to the Christmas tradition, both because of what he brought in his lifetime through his German heritage, but also how Victoria reacted to his death and to memorialise him? So was there almost a sort of double wave of that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly his death had a major impact on Victoria. I mean, she went from being someone who actually had a very sort of public life. You would see her very often driving through the parks, going to the theatre. You would see her, you know, regularly, to being somebody who was much more withdrawn for a very long time, for decades, in fact. I'm actually not sure about the impact that had on Christmas. It certainly had a big impact on Victoria herself. And actually, it was only in that period where she kind of retreated from public view that kind of public support for the monarchy started to drop a little bit as well. So, yeah, his death was certainly a momentous occasion.
Now, you mentioned the food, the feasting, the presents, that all sort of became magnified during this Victorian era. Were there thoughts during the time, sort of contemporaneous, that anyone thought this was to excess? Because clearly religious feelings were stronger at that time, and Christian teachings are of a simple life. That were there frictions at all in how Christmas began to be celebrated as you say, this sort of feasting element, this sort of show of enjoyment goes back a long, long time. But were there sort of elements that thought that this is going too far, or that this was changing what people thought of Christmas?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny because now when we hark back to a simpler time and imagine a kind of traditional Christmas, we tend to picture a Victorian one, don't we? And yet you're absolutely right that in the Victorian era, there were people moaning about exactly the same thing, saying, you know, why can't we go back to a more traditional medieval Christmas when, you know, there wasn't all of this kind of consumerism and pressure to buy presents and to kind of go all out at Christmas. So, yeah, very early on, you start to get articles in Victorian magazines where people are kind of adopting a Scrooge-like character, complaining about, you know, how much money they're having to spend and, oh, what a terrible waste it is and, you know, what a pain it is to have to spend all this time around your family. So, yeah, if there's one lesson from the history of Christmas, I think it's that we're always kind of dreaming of some golden age that maybe never existed, and always kind of moaning about the practical pain in the arse that Christmas kind of, you know, can create, alongside all of the lovely things that come with it. I think moaning about it is as big a part of Christmas traditions maybe as putting up a tree and singing a carol.
Well, I mean, that is a relief, I think, to people if they are feeling a little bit Scrooge, like that's part of the tradition. But I wonder then, can you shine a light on how early maybe the feelings of Christmas began in a year? Because I think one of the biggest gripes I certainly hear in my life is that, things are getting Christmassy in November, October, even September. I once saw a Christmas tree in August. So I don't know if they've just left it up. Who knows? But in the Victorian era, is there evidence for a sort of mission creep of Christmas back then?
Yeah, a little bit. So you would definitely start to see adverts for Christmas-related things in early December, which, I mean, for me, is sort of like, it's always been like the acceptable point. Once I hit December, that's when I'm like, okay, you know, we're in kind of the Christmas zone now. But it is still several weeks away. And so, yeah, you would get adverts for Christmas presents in Victorian newspapers, yeah, as early as December. But of course, like, the Christmas industry in the 19th century is rolling all year long. So one of the major products the Victorians invent is, of course, the Christmas cracker. That's something that emerges from the 1840s. And the main guy behind that, a guy named Tom Smith, had a Christmas cracker factory that was literally rolling every month of the year, constantly churning these things out. So the commercial side of it, in many ways, sort of never slept. It just sort of, I guess, emerged as a sort of part of public culture, yet largely in December. It would be rare to start seeing it creep into November, I think.
Yeah, see, I always think that's fair, you know. I think once you're in Advent and you've got the calendar, 24 days, that seems fair to me. I mean, it's like if I started banging on about my birthday like 2 or 3 months earlier, I think people would tell me to sort my life out. Maybe the Victorians had that right. When it comes to crackers, like as we talked about trees with their German influence, is there a European backdrop to the how the cracker came about as well?
Yeah, the whole kind of origin story of the cracker supposedly starts when this confectioner, a sort of sweet shop, a sweet manufacturer, Tom Smith, went to France and saw there these bonbons wrapped in some little bits of paper, which sort of resembled the shape of a cracker, kind of twisted at either end. And supposedly he was inspired by those to then start selling them in England, and he called them Christmas bonbons. Now, at that point, they don't have a lot of the things we would associate with a cracker, right? There's no crack, there's no little message or joke inside, no hat. But bit by bit, over the years, he began to kind of add these additional elements, and loads of other competitor manufacturers sprung up. So, yeah, it sort of has, its very origins, some European influence. But really, the Christmas cracker, as we know, is a British thing, and actually isn't a lot of parts of the world are really confused by the idea of Christmas crackers. You don't really get them in America, for instance. So it's really very much a British thing, I think, in the end.
Oh, we can be proud about that. That's one thing. And I suppose another aspect of the modern Christmas, which surely the Victorians supercharged, comes in the arts. And again, this is something you can't sort of pin on the royal family, as it were, but it's more of an overall flowering, would you say? That there, of course, there's Christmas carols. There's the literature, and most famously, of course, Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. So again, is this sort of just, these were manifestations of what was going on in the wider world, that artists were responding to Christmas becoming so popular?
Yeah, certainly. I think, I mean, Dickens is sometimes, I think, perhaps a little generously credited with inventing Christmas at this point with A Christmas Carol. And I think, like, a lot of those traditions do predate him. But there's no doubt that he was, you know, very sort of influential in shaping how people sort of viewed, you know, Christmas traditions. And you're right, there is such an outpouring in the Victorian period of, yeah, I guess, artworks, products linked to Christmas. Yeah, you're right, you know, songs, Christmas pantomimes, you've got, literature like Charles Dickens. Actually, one of the big ones that kind of reminds me of our modern culture as well is the special edition of a Victorian magazine. So most magazines will put out a special Christmas issue, and it would be, you know, bigger than all the others. It would give away really fancy, you know, colour illustrations. Sometimes they would have, you know, massive competitions in the magazine. One of my favourites, a magazine named Titbits, for their Christmas competition, gave away a house as a kind of Christmas prize, where you had to sort of send in the best story. And it was this sort of semi-detached house in London that they gave away, and called the Titbits Villa.
Wow.
So, yeah, that idea of, yeah, I mean, it's still there now. You can still find it on Google Street View. I would love to know if the people who live there know they live in the Titbits Villa. But that's, I guess, an example of that flourishing of print culture. You know, this is a time when the production of things like newspapers, magazines got cheaper and cheaper. The government stops taxing them as much. And yeah, there is a massive sort of flowering of images, of text. And yeah, people seem to enjoy buying this stuff. Actually, Dickens is another good example, right? Christmas Carol. That's not just a story about Christmas. He intended that book to be a Christmas present. You know, he made them, you know, he was really sort of hands-on with the design of that book, made them really beautifully bound, really nice objects. So he knew that they weren't just a thing to be read about Christmas, but to be given at Christmas, to be enjoyed as a physical thing. So yeah, this is very much a period for all of that, really, that mass production of text, of items.
Well, you mentioned gifting there again, and that brings me to one of the characters we haven't mentioned yet, which is Father Christmas or St. Yeah. Nicholas. We know that in the 20th century, the corporate aspect of Santa through sort of Coca-Cola, the costuming of the character changed. How big an element was Father Christmas, Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, call him what you will, in the Victorian period?
Well, actually, so you say call him what you will, but actually there are sort of two almost parallel characters going on here that we've since sort of melded together. Mm. So Father Christmas, that's the traditional British figure. You look back at illustrations of him from the early 19th century, and he's not this kind of quite, you know, innocent, jovial figure just handing out presents to kids and driving a sleigh around.
Oh, where are you going?
He's this Lord of Christmas. Yeah, don't worry, there is no great scandal here. But
good.
You will sort of see illustrations of him, you know, swigging glasses of wine and really sort of partying and having a great time. And he's sort of, you know, the Lord of Christmas, of the festivities, a kind of the bacchanalian figure.
Yes.
Santa Claus is more of a, well, actually, you know, he comes from kind of Dutch tradition, then kind of imported into America through Dutch migrants. And he kind of becomes, you know, that figure who's going to deliver presents, you know, on his sleigh. He then gets imported into Britain in the kind of middle of the 19th century. And bit by bit, those figures, the old-fashioned Father Christmas, the kind of the lord of the party, and the slightly more recognisably modern Santa Claus start to get merged together. But it's not until, we reckon, around the sort of maybe even last decade of the 19th century that you would get that tradition of British kids writing letters to Santa asking for presents. Before that, though, you know, the myth starts to emerge a bit about, you know, him coming down the chimney. So it's very much a thing that is invented gradually. And again, through this kind of melting pot of all sorts of different cultural influences.
So would you say that the Santa Claus part of that figure has won out? Because we think of the present giving. It's interesting, so many people say, no, he's called Father Christmas, not Santa Claus. But we see less of that bacchanalian, Dionysian sort of wine quaffing Santa, maybe, or maybe a little bit when he comes down the chimney. But the present giving and the workshop and the elves seems to have taken over. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I think that myth has definitely won out now. And you could probably start to see that happening in the 19th century. And that's partly because Christmas, as the Victorian era goes on, becomes increasingly about children. They become really sort of centred in the festival. You know, obviously the giving of gifts and all of the kind of wonderful storytelling about, you know, Father Christmas coming down the chimney and leaving those gifts, that becomes a more prominent part of the Christmas story. Before that, I guess you could say Father Christmas was aimed at a figure much more adult, right? The people going on these sort of these feastings, these drinkings, this sort of good night out. That becomes, I mean, still part of Christmas. I think anyone who was sort of out on last Friday night before Christmas in towns will probably tell you that's still a big part of what we do this time of year. But yeah, I think you're right. That vision of Father Christmas has become a bit more tame, a bit more sort of domesticated and a bit more focused on children's experience of Christmas.
And just finally then, I mean, you've taken us through so many of the ways in which in the 19th century, and particularly in the Victorian era, Christmas has become what we all know it as. Would you say, because the Victorian stamp on our culture is so vast in so many ways, was it an overall force for good, for positives? Do you think they created something that we should all cherish? Or are there areas in which they've changed everything so much that we lost something that came before?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's kind of hard to put a pin on it. I guess it depends what you want from Christmas. If you really like that kind of family-focused sort of season of goodwill rather than the kind of bacchanalian parties, then I guess, you know, you'll probably quite like what the Victorians brought to the table. If you kind of yearn for a more of a kind of, you know, a pagan festival of misrule, maybe you'll think that they took a bit of the edge off of it. But they did do some pretty wild things. I mean, one of my favourite Christmas traditions that was really popular in the Victorian era that has gone is a game called Snapdragon, which most people probably won't have heard of now. But this went back to the sort of 17th century, but you would get a dish, wide dish, fill it full of brandy, put some raisins in it, set it alight, turn off the lights, and then the game was you were meant to reach your hand into this burning dish, pluck a raisin out and stick it in your mouth. And this was incredibly popular with children in the 19th century.
Oh my God.
So in some ways, you know, yeah, I know. Like, so I'm not recommending you try this at home because I think it could probably be pretty dangerous. But that's, I guess, an example of where the Victorians were willing to still do some quite sort of wild, almost pagan-like things that we've then since sort of lost. So if we're kind of saying that Christmas has become too tame and too kind of commercialised, you can blame the Victorians a bit for that. But I think, you know, we're still doing plenty of that ourselves.
Wow. Well, as you say, I think we won't go so far as to recommend Snapdragon over Snap. Yeah, that's good to know. And I think these days everyone can sort of, people tend to pick and choose what they do with their Christmas and how debauched they choose to be. Thank you so much for giving us such a wonderful insight into how the Victorians changed and in so many ways made our modern Christmas. Dr. Bob, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Merry Christmas.
That was historian and writer Dr. Bob Nicholson telling us all about the Victorian influences on our modern day Christmas.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
It's Gitta Hari and Rosie Wright standing in for Stig Abel and Kate McCann on Times Radio Breakfast. We'll bring you the news you need to know before Christmas from 6 a.m.
We'll speak to the former Conservative Minister Edwina Curry and The Times' Andrew Billen, and we'll officially open the airspace for Father Christmas.
Times Radio Breakfast. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
As you know, I'm more of an expert on rap than I am on the markets.
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee delve a bit further into the day's news and give their views on all the hot topics of the day.
Let's not accuse anybody at this stage in the game. Or should we?
No, let's not.
Unencumbered and off air.
I don't think that we should spend too long
talking about that night when I wasn't there.
Oh no, I'm going to bring it up.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times Radio app.
Simplify making tax digital for income tax with Xero. If you're a sole trader or landlord, you'll need to use HMRC recognized software like Xero to track your income and expenses, share quarterly updates, and submit your final tax return. Xero accounting software gives you a clear view of your financial picture, and with each quarterly update, you'll see your estimated tax bill, helping to avoid those nasty year-end surprises. Simply snap, scan, and sort receipts on your phone and on the go, so your records stay organized all year round, putting an end to the January panic and the piles of paperwork. With Xero, go beyond compliance and gain better control of your business finances. Your records stay up to date automatically, invoicing and payments run online, and a better view of your numbers helps you plan ahead. Less scramble at year end, more confidence all year. Change the way you see making tax digital with Xero. Search MTD Ready.
Hugo Rifkin at Christmas on Times Radio.
I'll be speaking to Catelyn Moran as we review all the Christmas cards this year sent by politicians, royals and celebrities. Matt Rudd will explain why banning Christmas music and stocking up on batteries are among his 10 rules for surviving the day. We'll be looking back at when the Puritans cancelled Christmas. Plus, I'll bring you a review of the year's news, recorded in front of a live audience and featuring some of the sharpest minds from the times.
Hugo Rifkin at Christmas. Christmas Day from 10 a.m. on Times Radio.
Christmas on Times Radio.
Right, well, that's it from me. Tomorrow, you can hear the fabulous Jane Mulcairns here between 1 and 4. Don't forget, you can join Times Radio live on air on Christmas morning with Callum MacDonald, hosting his now iconic show from the Western Isles from 7 a.m. Thank you to my wonderful team, Rosie, Joseph, Ellie, Eve and Robin. I'm off to have a baby. Well, not me personally. The hero is my wife. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, John, and a happy Christmas to you and your family. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pina. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. Ministers raise the inheritance tax relief threshold for farmers, and two Islamic State supporters are found guilty of planning what police say could have been Britain's most deadly gun attack on Jewish targets in Manchester. And coming up, another government climb down, this time over inheritance tax. I'll be talking about what happened and what it means, talking to the president of the NFU. Parts of the Labour Party want the government to get closer to the EU. Patrick English from YouGov will tell us what the public are thinking about all of that. And in our regular feature, Unlocking AI, the Times' Ben Clapworthy and Tom Whipple go head-to-head over whether artificial intelligence really is a force for good.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Daryl Jackson.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The National Farmers Union says many of its members will sleep more easily this Christmas after a government U-turn on inheritance tax. The threshold is increasing from £1 million to £2.5 million. It's following months of protests and tractors descending on Westminster. Here's the Environment Secretary, Emma Reynolds.
We listen to those farmers and businesses who will be affected. And as a result, 85% of farming estates who claim agricultural property relief will now pay no inheritance tax.
Two men have been convicted of plotting a mass shooting targeting Jewish people in Manchester. Preston Crown Court heard Waleed Sadawi and Ammar Hussein were inspired by Islamic State. Police chiefs say it could have been Britain's deadliest terrorist incident. Frank Ferguson is head of counter-terrorism for the Crown Prosecution Service.
They were going to seek out an event where many people would be gathering, such as a march, and attack the Jewish community, and then move to another area of Manchester where there were schools, synagogues and nurseries and shops, and carry out further atrocities there.
Sadawi's brother, Bilal, was found guilty of failing to disclose information about the plan. Tens of thousands of pages of files about the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein have been unsealed. The US Justice Department's also issued a statement saying they contain untrue and sensationalist claims about Donald Trump. The batch includes an email sent by someone signing off as A at Balmoral, asking Ghislaine Maxwell for new inappropriate friends. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and Mr. Trump have always denied wrongdoing. A man's appeared in court in Swindon charged with 56 sexual offences against his ex-wife. Philip Young's accused of drugging and raping his former partner over a 13-year period. He's been remanded into custody. Greta Thunberg has been arrested in central London at a protest backing Palestine Action hunger strikers. City of London police say a 22-year-old woman was detained for displaying a placard supporting a banned group. A mid-Ashes holiday enjoyed by England's cricketers in Australia is being investigated by their bosses. They had a break in the Queensland beach town of Noosa, where some players reportedly drank excessively before losing the third test and the series. But former England bowler Steve Harmison's told us it's not a black-and-white situation.
If they've gone 60 a bender, bang them against the wall, they get what they deserve. If they've been caught having a couple of pints in the middle of the afternoon, yeah, when the world is ending, yeah, I'm not hammering them for this.
And a leading dog rescue charity has warned they'll be operating at capacity this Christmas. The Dogs Trust says the number of inquiries from owners about giving up their pets remains high following a peak in inquiries in 2022. Richard Moore from the charity says so far this year they've managed to rehome more than 8,500 animals.
We had 50,000 people call us over the course of 2022 needing help to find homes for their dogs, and we expect over 40,000 calls for similar reasons before the end of this year.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, as government U-turns go, this is a big one. Also came rather late in the day, hitting farms worth £1 million or more in the last budget, but one caused howls of protest. Parliament Square jammed with tractors, driven by angry farmers, complaining, it seemed perfectly reasonably, that their slim hopes of passing their farms down to the next generation had been sunk. Now, today, almost slipped out in a press release, the government suddenly announced the trigger point for inheritance tax had been raised to £2.5 million. So up to £5 million where the allowance passes to a surviving spouse. The National Farmers Union is naturally pleased, certainly relieved. Why did it take so long for the government to come round? We're going to hear in a moment from the NFU president, Tom Bradshaw. And later on, speaking of time-hallowed features of national life, the church is worried that the so-called mansion tax on higher-priced homes will force parish priests who are often far from being wealthy to leave their homes, their vicarages, and move to places away from their parishioners. I wonder if the government will give way on that too. What are you thinking? What's on your mind? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, let's look at the news breaking as we were coming on air a little earlier on. The government's watered down those proposals to tax inherited farmland. The planned threshold increases from £1 million to £2.5 million. At last year's budget, it was announced the 20% tax on inherited agricultural assets would be in place from April 2026. And here's the Environment Secretary, Emma Reynolds, speaking today.
We've listened to farmers and businesses across the country, and we want to protect more family farms and businesses. So we're announcing today that we're increasing the inheritance tax threshold for individuals from £1 million to £2.5 million. So that means a couple with an estate worth up to £5 million will pay no inheritance tax when they pass on their estate to the next generation.
So then, let us now welcome to the programme Times policy editor, Ollie Wright, who's on the line. Hi to you, Oliver.
Hello.
It's good to have you here. It is a big U-turn, this, and you have to just reflect on the fact the government soaked so much grief up all that protest before suddenly announcing it today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, there's a theme here, isn't there? I mean, winter fuel payments, the changes to welfare. The government has this sort of uncanny knack of announcing policies that are deeply unpopular, taking all the political pain for it, and then U-turning at the last minute and not getting any of the financial gain from it. It is really, really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, well, the farmers are happy enough from all that we've seen so far. We're going to hear from the National Farmers Union in just a second. And the public were behind the farmers pretty strongly. I saw a poll, 58% behind the farmers. It just never seemed a smart move politically, I mean, considering the fairly limited revenue that it raised.
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. You know, even after 5 years, the tax was only actually going to make £530 million, which is a sort of absolute drop in the ocean of the sort of £1.1 trillion that the government makes each year in taxes. And, you know, you wonder why they allowed it to go on for this long. There have been plenty of opportunities for the government to sort of listen to the farmers to say, actually, you know what, we probably got this wrong, we need to change it. And they could have escaped a huge amount of pain from it. But, you know, I think the other interesting element to all this is, even in the budget last month, Reeves did not announce this climb down. So something has happened since then.
Yes.
And, you know, it makes her look weak.
It is certainly so sudden. I mean, Niccolo Machiavelli, in his book, The Prince, he gives some advice. If you're going to make a concession, make it look generous. And he might have said, don't slip it out in a press release with the minister giving a quick pool clip.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the reason...